Snap Studios. Snap. Qasem Eid had spent 2 years living in a city under siege. After he and his neighbors took part in the protests during the Arab Spring of 2011, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad began to punish towns like Qasem's. His forces bombed them, surrounded them, and starved them. Sensitive listeners should know, this story contains graphic scenes of war. Here's Qasem.
I started looking into trash. I started looking for food in the streets. I started eating grass. One time, me and my friend were like really, really hungry, and we went out at night to look for anything to eat. So we were walking downtown, and we saw a house who was like recently bombarded by the regime. And there was only like few walls standing. And I don't know how I saw a jar in the rubble. And inside that jar, there was almost like a handful of jam, pumpkin jam. And it had a very thick layer of dirt and like rotten stuff. It was like something you will see in normal days and perhaps make you throw up. But all what I saw was food, and not any food, like sugar, you know? And me and my friend just, with our hands, we like swept away that thick layer of dirt. Then we start like just with our fingers, just eating this rotten, dirty pumpkin jam. And I think, I don't know what happened to us, but somehow we felt like we got high. We got like stoned or something. Like it felt so good. Like it was perhaps the most delicious dessert I ever had in my life.
Thousands of Syrians have lost their lives in the conflict between forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad and fighters opposed to his rule. An end to the conflict still doesn't seem to be in sight.
Everyone who wants to really know what happened in Syria must understand that when the revolution happened, we had nothing to lose. It came after more than 4 decades of living under tyranny and injustice and a lousy economy.
Where protests erupted in March 2011. Anti-Assad demonstrations broke out in other towns and cities. The government quickly turned to military force to crush the protests. All of a sudden, it was less like public unrest and more like civil war.
The regime started to, let's say, punish Mu'addamiya, sending car bombs, cutting the power, the water, the internet, daily bombardment for more than 2 years. But the worst part was the starvation. Sometimes, believe it or not, on the front lines, Assad soldiers used to make barbecues and play music, and we would like just smell the food. Because of the government bombardment and arrests and massacres and violence, life was just too dangerous in Mu'addamiya. My mother went to Jordan. Some of my brothers were outside of Syria. Some of them were still stuck on the borders trying to flee. Most of my friends killed or captured. The reasons that made me protest and become a rebel. I rebelled because I felt injustice during my entire life. I rebelled because I was arrested and tortured. I rebelled because I didn't get my chance in school.
I was perhaps the most active spokesperson for the opposition in English inside Syria back in 2013.
I've seen a lot of my friends, a lot of dear friends of mine who used to, you know, enjoy life, and when they became fighters, they've changed. It made them somehow cruel, and I was afraid that I might like it or fall into it. I was afraid that I don't know, I will get used to it. I never fought before, never used weapons in my life, so I tried my best to stay away from it as far as possible and as much as I could, but I couldn't, not until the end.
Money became useless. Like, there's nothing to buy. I remember I used to see like children playing during the day while the bombardment is very, very strong. I used to go and like beg them, please go to your home, you might get killed. And they just ignore me or tell me just go away, whatever. Then I will like yell at them, try to scare them away, and they won't get scared. Then I try to bribe them, like give them money, like $10. I used to like take money out of my pocket and tell them like, if you're gonna go home, I will give you this. Like the kids used to throw the money in my face and tell me, give us a piece of bread and we'll do anything you want. Just a piece of bread. And I had no answer. I used to sometimes like go to their families, like, come, take your children inside. Like some of them actually, they were saying like, let them play outside. Better than them staying inside and crying, asking for food that I don't have. Let them play. What if a bomb fell? Well, then it will be a merciful way for them to leave this world. They will go somewhere where there's a lot of food, where they won't be hurt anymore. So, Muslims, we have 5 prayers a day.
I remember one time
when it was time for the early morning prayer, I just pulled my head off the bed, walked a few steps, and out of nowhere I started hearing really terrifying sirens, alarms coming from Damascus. And that was the very first time I hear this sound in the revolution. I was like, what's going on? Like, what's that? So I got close to the window. After 2 years of living under bombardment and siege, you get to know like what kind of weapon the regime is using right now. You can tell, yeah, it's a tank, you know, it's artillery, it's a mortar, it's whatever, it's a missile. But that was the very first time I hear this sound. Out of nowhere, I just felt like my lungs were blocked. I started feeling like I was choking. I wasn't able to breathe. I wasn't able to scream. I started having this severe pain in my eyes, in my chest, in my heart. I didn't know if I was dreaming or if this is real. I didn't know. Like, I didn't know. So my reaction was to beat my chest with my hand, my fist, and try as much as I can with all the strength that I had just to breathe, just to try to take a single breath. And it was so painful. I took the first breath and I started screaming like, I don't know what, trying to wake up my friends. And then I ran to the bathroom and started washing my eyes with water, with my face, splashing it all over, trying to take some of that pain, the burning pain from my eyes, trying to wake up. My friend starts waking up, coughing, struggling to breathe. The neighbor starts screaming. We didn't know what to do. We start putting our pants on and, I don't know, a t-shirt, something, looking for our keys. I don't know, just trying to leave as fast as possible. Then I got to the street. And my God. Like, it was something that I always describe it as Judgment Day, that scene. You know, we hear, we read about it in the Bible or Quran, that how people will be so shocked, so afraid. When they wake up from the dead, the confusion, the terror. That's the closest thing I can describe. Men, women, and children running, falling on the ground, suffocating, like screaming in agony and terror. I saw a little boy to my left, his face down, he was choking, nobody was there. So I ran to try to see if I can help him or something. I turned him around, put him on his back. And like, I will never ever forget the look on that little boy's face. His eyes were like glassy. He was vomiting this white foam. His lungs were making this horrible sound. I ripped off his shirt, started giving him CPR, pushing on his heart, lungs. I started taking that white foam out of his mouth. First with my fingers, then with my mouth, and spit it away. And I started screaming and crying like a widow. I stayed with him for almost a minute before my friend Alamdar got his car. He had an old white Range Rover. It was packed with children and maybe two ladies. All of them were suffocating. You can just see arms and legs. He drove very fast, and while he was driving through the streets of Maddamia, I was watching the same scene all over. People running, falling on the ground. Second, we got to the field hospital. I wanted to carry the kid out of the car. He seemed heavier than when I first carried him. While I was trying to carry him, I lost conscious and I fell on the ground. They said that the doctors gave me atropine, CPR, washed my body, but my heart stopped. They checked my pulse. There was no pulse. They moved on. They had more than 600, maybe 700 people. There were people helping them to like put the dead bodies on the side, put people who have a chance to live on the other side. Yeah, they saw, thought I was dead. I woke up surrounded with dead bodies. Took me a few minutes to remember where am I and what happened. Minutes later, my friends came. They noticed somehow I was moving or trying to move or I don't know what. And they called on the doctors again. They came, they gave me, I don't know, 3, maybe 4 shots of atropine, a lot of CPR, washed my body until I woke up. Yeah. I was opening my eyes. People were screaming and shouting, some out of joy for me being alive. My friends told me you should go out to get fresh air because the air was contaminated. I didn't understand what they said. I actually, at the beginning, I didn't recognize who they are. I didn't recognize where I am. I didn't know if I am alive or dead. So anyways, my friends helped me to go outside. When I went outside, and things were starting to clear up minute after minute. Everybody was calling me Qasim. So started saying, well, I guess my name is Qasim. I started feeling a little bit cold. Then I looked at my body and I noticed that I was only in my underwear and I was covered with water. I asked one of my friends to bring me a jacket or something. He told me all of my clothes were like filled with sarin. I was like, sarin, what are you saying? What's sarin? This is what the doctors are saying. They're saying it's sarin gas.
Syria used sarin gas on its own people, killing.
Activists say more than 1,300 people were killed in 2013 during a sarin gas attack.
You see the frothing in the mouth. You see people having convulsive activity, and people simply can't breathe. And it's a terrible way to die.
While my friend was coming back to get me my jacket, I heard a big explosion. Then another, then another, then like the earth literally started shaking under my feet. People started screaming, Assad is bombing, Assad is bombing, run, hide. I saw like young men carrying AKs, running and screaming, go to the front lines if you can fight. The government forces are trying to invade.
I never had the urge or the need or the will to actually go to the front lines. But after surviving that chemical attack, after seeing the horrors and seeing how brutal those men are, after I woke up, all what I was thinking about was just fighting back. The look on that little boy's face, I will never forget it. And I wanted revenge.
That was the very first time I fought in my life.
When Snap Judgment returns, Qasem heads to the front lines. Stay tuned. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. When last we left, Qasem's town was being bombarded by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And that's when he decided to join the rebel army and for the first time ever, head to the front lines.
There was like 20 young men. They were all trying to load their AKs. They were arguing about how they should use the ammunition because we had no ammunition, nothing, like a couple of hand grenades and I don't know, maybe 2,000-3,000 rounds for more than 20 fighters. So FSA, the Free Syrian Army leader, he gave me an AK and two clips and a hand grenade and sneakers because I was barefoot too. And we tried to go to the front lines. We ran outside, bombs were falling, tanks were roaring, like I said. Three, maybe four of the guys who were with us died just while we were trying to cross the streets, like mortars fell off the sky and they were shred to pieces. We got to the front lines. I saw the tanks. I saw Assad troops wearing like chemical gear protection. Like they were wearing masks and gloves. Yeah, I was stationed to cover a corner with another guy. Yeah, and my job was just to make sure if I see a soldier trying to cross the street to shoot at him. So it's very hard to see.
There was this like crazy death symphony, if we can call it this way. When I saw the soldiers coming, my heartbeats went crazy. I was very nervous and, I don't know, overwhelmed. I pulled the trigger, not knowing if I'm doing the right thing or the wrong thing, but I desperately wanted to pull that trigger. And when I did, I became a new person. I don't know if better or worse, but I've changed. I remember I was very sad after surviving the chemical attack. I just started walking and walking, and while I was walking, they were bombing and there was no electricity. Wherever I walk, I will just hear people crying or bombs falling. It was very dark. And then I kept walking until I got to the olive trees. I started to remember my childhood and all the good times that we spent here. I felt like hugging someone, there was nobody. So I looked around and I hugged an olive tree. I don't know, it gave me some kind of comfort. The wind started blowing and I felt like the olive tree was practically hugging me back. I will tell you a story. One time, a month or two after the chemical attack, I was walking in the street in Mad Damia, and I heard a plane roaring, and I just looked up the sky. I saw a fireball like a few meters away from me. In front of me, there was a little girl with her family. They were walking. The missile exploded, and they literally vanished. All I can see is smoke and this really awful scent of burned flesh. And I saw blood on my hands, blood on my face, on my t-shirt, and I thought that I was hit, but I wasn't even scratched. I wanted to take off my clothes and wash my body. I don't know, and end my life. I just couldn't take it. I was shocked. I was so angry. I ran back home. I took my rifle. I started running. I was running nonstop like Forrest Gump. People were asking me, where am I going? I didn't answer. I didn't talk to anyone. And I got to the front lines in the northern part of the town, where on the other side, a couple of 100 meters away, there's an officer residence where Assad officers and their families and their mercenaries lived there. It was a very reckless place to be. And I went up in a building, like destroyed building, you know, second or third floor. And I put the scoop and I started searching for someone to kill. I saw an officer, an Assad officer, wearing his uniform, sitting with his wife and kid on the balcony. He was wearing the military uniform. She was holding like papers in her hands. She looked like a school teacher. And they had a little boy. He was like sad and crying, I don't know what, and the father was trying to make him happy, like laugh and like joke with him. Like the kid was pointing downstairs. I looked downstairs on the street. There was other kids were playing. I think he wanted to go play there. And his father didn't let him, so figure out he just loves him too much, or
He's too afraid to let him go downstairs. They had food, they had power, they had everything. They were just like a couple of hundred meters away from us. And I kept looking at the father, at the officer. And at that moment, I just saw him as a father. I didn't see him as a soldier who helps a dictator kill his own people. And I had this argument in my head. Should I take the shot or not? Should I kill him or not? Like, everything in me wanted to pull that trigger so much. But I just couldn't do it. Not in front of his wife, not in front of his kid. While I was staring, the regime started bombing the town with artillery. And I knew that those bombs are killing people right now while I'm staring at that guy. Like, the wife didn't even blink when the bombs came out. Like, they didn't blink, not even the kid. The kids downstairs kept playing. I didn't pull the trigger. And I went back, and my revenge was being better than them. That's what I told myself.
Thanks so much to Qasem Eid for sharing his story with The Snap. Qasem is currently living as a refugee in Germany, but was recently accepted into Columbia University. Super congratulations. And check out his book, My Country. It's out now. I have a link to the book and his social media at snapjudgment.org. Original score for that story was by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Liz Mack.